Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday, February 25th, 2026 meeting of the Minnesota House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. We do have a majority and a quorum present. Our first order of business is to approve the minutes from yesterday's meeting, Tuesday, February 24th, 2026. And Representative Dotseff.
Mr. Chair, a correction on the spelling of my last of my first name. It's Jeff, not Seth. On the policy committee minutes.
Representative Dotseff, tell me again where you're seeing a correction.
Where my members present, it says Seth Dotseff. It's actually Jeff Dotseff.
Oh, I gotcha. I gotcha.
You have
other
Seth?
I do. I
identify. Well, maybe Seth is supposed to be on the committee and you've been an imposter. But the correction is duly noted. Anything else? Then with that correction, Representative Dotseff, are you comfortable with moving the minutes for approval?
So moved.
Motion by Dotseff. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry.
There was two more testifiers on 1750.
Go to the mic if you will.
Oh, sorry. There was two more testifiers. There was Mr.
Keenan Rivety.
Keenan Rivety.
And a Matt
McNeil. And Matt McNeil.
And then have we had a chance to, I know the CLA from your team took the minutes and stuff yesterday, so I'm hoping that we've got the track. We can get back to them with the corrections on those as well. Okay. Any other corrections, additions? Seeing none, hearing none, let's try that again. Representative Dotseff, would you like to move the minutes one more time?
So
as corrected.
As corrected.
Very good. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. Hopefully that's the most difficult thing we have to deal with today in front of the committee. We have two items before the committee today, and I'd like to background both of these for the committee at large for the benefit of the new members and staff that are here, as well as our returning members. Last year, we had a number of things that have affected what we do in the commerce arena, and we're coming back with two of those. One, we had a task force that looked at insurance in the state of Minnesota, and we're going to take that report by Representative Elkins. It was his idea last year, and we're going to take that as number two. Our number one item this week is, or today, I should say, is to look at the CFB, the Commerce Fraud Bureau, and that was nested in the Minnesota Department of Commerce for a number of years. And for the background on the committee, the investigators who are a part of this are funded by an assessment on the insurance companies that sell property and casualty insurance here in the state of Minnesota, among other products. And what happened was we created this position. They had a lot of authority, and they also had members of the sworn law enforcement community that were part of their ranks to go after the wrongdoers who were committing fraud and the like. And about 2 years ago, the Commerce Department came to the Commerce Committee and said, we'd like to add additional investigators. And begrudgingly, but because of the need, the industry came forward and said, yes, they would support assessing insurance companies even more funds to support a growth in that department. What ended up happening is through an executive order in early January of 2025, this team was removed from Commerce and nested then in the BCA, or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We had some hearings and some discussions on that. And one of the things that we had said we were going to do is we were going to be bringing back the commissioners and the superintendent of the BCA to report to us how that integration is going and to allow the committee the opportunity to ask questions. Even though that is no longer nested in the Department of Commerce, but is in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, it is still money that we have in jurisdiction that we have as a committee in the commerce area, since we regulate the insurance industry and fraud is a byproduct of that, not a positive byproduct, but is nonetheless a byproduct. And it's very important for this committee to be abreast of what's going on with those issues and making sure that the consuming public is getting what they need in the way of the CFB. And so with that as the background for staff and for members, that's the purpose for today's conversation. We're going to have the two commissioners who are involved in this, Commissioner Jacobson and Commissioner Arnold, as well as Drew Evans, who is the superintendent of the BCA. And so with that, our first update is going to be coming from Grace Arnold, who is the commissioner of the Commerce Department, and maybe she would also like to have Bob Jacobson, the commissioner of public safety, with her at that time. And Mr. Evans, you may as well come up as well, all at the same time. But we'll start with Grace, since it was in her area, and she can talk about and fill in some things, and then we'll move to the commissioner and the superintendent with their update. And of course, we'll certainly take member questions as they come up, either along the way or at the end of the presentation. And so members, ask and take notes and take and ask thoughtful questions, because it is your charge to make sure that the folks in the who are buying insurance are protected. And so this is your chance to ask questions. And again, this committee does a very nice job of being professional and asking those questions, and so I do encourage that. And so with that, to all three of you, welcome. And Commissioner Arnold, I'm going to go ahead and defer to you, if you'll state your name for the record, and then tell us what we need to know since the last time we were visiting with you. Again, great. Welcome.
Can you all hear me? Okay, I'll try to. My voice doesn't project very well, so tell me if you can't hear, but I will try to lean in. So Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Cagle, and the members of the House Commerce Committee, for the record, my name is Grace Arnold, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm here to provide an update on the transfer of the former Commerce Fraud Bureau to the Department of Public Safety under the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Before I speak to the transfer, I think Chair O'Driscoll kind of set me up well to talk about this, but I think it's really important to remember that fraud can and does impact all of us. It can look innocuous. I don't know how many people here probably have gotten a text message that says something like, call me, or hey, we missed our lunch date, and often those lead to fraudulent activity. It may lead your elderly relative to send money to someone that they don't know. It might look like a business that's illegally trying to avoid paying workers' compensation insurance premiums. Or it can look like a fake auto accident where the perpetrator pockets the claim money. Or it can look like a business illegally taking taxpayer money for services it didn't actually perform. The governor views addressing fraud as a top priority. I think we've seen a lot of that over the last year. We've made systematic changes to state government. If you commit fraud in Minnesota, you'll be caught and prosecuted to the full extent of the law. This includes creating a centralized fraud investigations unit at the BCA, and that effort allows the administration to focus resources and funding to better investigate fraud and hold fraudsters accountable for their crimes. So I'll update you a little bit on the work since we last visited. We worked really diligently to transfer the unit over to BCA. On our side, that looked like a lot of making sure that they had what they had at Commerce at BCA. So that meant that we worked through data access issues. We made sure that they had resources to investigate complicated insurance fraud schemes and that our referral process was in good shape. That meant that we entered into a formal data sharing agreement. We assisted the BCA in obtaining access to insurance-related databases. Some of those come out of associations that we're a member of. We drafted legislative amendments together. We updated referral forms. And then we also worked on a parallel proceedings policy. So for our civil investigators and our criminal investigators, we made sure that there was some amount of parallelity between the two where it made sense. It's different kinds of investigations, but we wanted to make sure that those sort of worked together. And then we also, we had a long history with the Auto Theft Prevention Program, and so gave some advice on how to structure that. And we had made some changes over the last couple of years, so just making sure that the BCA team kind of understood what those changes had, what had resulted in those changes, and how it had improved the program. So while fraud now resides within the BCA, they remain a really crucial partner to us at the Department of Commerce in our fraud prevention efforts. We have informal conversations. The humans at both agencies still know each other, still call each other. And then we have formal processes. So we've referred 13 formal investigations over to the BCA in the last year, 2 from the senior fraud team, and 11 for insurance-related referrals in our customer services department, which intakes information from citizens. The department also routinely refers callers informally to the BCA when complaints may involve a criminal element, but it's not like a department area, and so it may not, we can refer, like someone can call us for any number of reasons, right, and we will refer over if it's not necessarily insurance, but it seems like there may be a crime. So we also do that and have done that for a long time. We've also seen investigations that began at Commerce conclude with charges. So there was a 22-month investigation by the BCA Financial Crimes Unit and before that the Fraud Bureau, where they were able to charge the owner of the Lucent Lodge with 3 felony arson counts and 1 felony count for insurance fraud for that burning of that historic lodge. And I think, successful investigations like this are a hallmark. They were a hallmark of the Fraud Bureau, and you can see that investigation, although it took a long time because these things do, seeing it through to conclusion was a really good, I think, indication that the transition worked well and that work is continuing under the BCA's watch. Beyond formal data sharing and agreements and referring cases for investigation, we meet regularly to ensure that there's a consistent flow of information between the two agencies. And that can look like industry trends, emerging patterns. Sometimes our civil investigations, folks will see things that don't show up on the criminal side until later, or the criminal folks will see things that don't show up on the civil side until later. And so we have opportunities for that collaboration in addition to the more formal referrals of like a specific case. So I really appreciate the time to give you an update on the work that we've done, and I'll turn it over to Commissioner Jacobson, and then unless you want to, I assume you want to do questions at the end. But
yeah, I just check along the way. Is there any member question specifically right now on the testimony from the Commissioner of Commerce, Grace Arnold? If not, then we'll move to Commissioner Jacobson. Good morning and welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record and proceed with your update. Again, welcome.
Well, thank you. Good to see you. So many familiar faces. Chair O'Driscoll, Cagle, Co-Chair Cagle, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jacobson, and I have the honor of serving as the Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. I'm joined here by Superintendent Drew Evans. I do want to thank you for the opportunity to provide you with an update today on the work with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Financial Crimes, and Fraud Unit. As you're aware, on January 3rd, 2025, Governor Wall signed an executive order creating a centralized state fraud investigation unit to ensure Minnesota has a coordinated approach to fight fraud. The legislature codified this language into law during the 2025 legislative session. Centralizing law enforcement fraud resources within the BCA creates efficiencies, locating resources and expertise into one place. And integrating the Commerce Fraud Unit into the BCA has had and will continue to have a positive impact on Minnesota's criminal fraud investigations. With that, I'll turn it over for details to BCA Superintendent Evans to provide more information about this unit.
Thank you, Commissioner. Sure. And Superintendent Evans, welcome. If you'll identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your update and testimony.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. My name is Drew Evans, and I'm the Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Thank you for having us today, Chair O'Driscoll and Chair Cagle and members of the committee. I'll state at the outset, the only thing that might be a little more dangerous than sitting between two of you is between two commissioners, so I will do my best to move through this. But our goal here is to give an overview, and the slide deck is on the side, of some of the information that we've been working on over the last year. And then, as noted by both commissioners, we're happy to answer any questions. As noted,
interrupt you for 1 second. Members, you also have that slide deck in your package just for reference. Sorry about the interruption. Superintendent, proceed.
Thank you, Chair. As noted already, this came about, I think, by a couple different people explaining this through Executive Order 2501. There's a number of different pieces to that particular executive order, but part of that was combining all fraud resources combating criminal fraud in the state of Minnesota, centralizing by combining both the BCA financial crime section and then our Commerce Fraud Bureau into one particular section. It's been, for your reference, now codified in BCA statute 299C.061, along with some responsibilities and duties and reporting, and in particular to this committee amongst the others of jurisdiction. Through the last year, we've been working to combine that unit, the section working on this work daily, and we've gained a number of different efficiencies by working on that. Our digital evidence now that had to be processed within the unit itself is done by a separate digital multimedia evidence team. It's a very large digital evidence section within our laboratory processes. Other resources were redirected to financial crimes as needed for targeted investigations. Just this morning, we're out with two different teams, our human trafficking team and the financial crimes team, working on a case that both has fraud implications. As the Commissioner noted, it's really throughout all types of crime that we see and human trafficking that we're doing. Standardized processes for evidence collection and storage in that digital infrastructure to process large case files and other evidence. Standardized training, working across more comprehensive and specialized training by having a larger section. We're able to have more specialization just across the board and also learning from each other, the expertise that came from both teams. We can build kind of redundancy in those specializations. For example, we have now each team had two people specialized in cryptocurrency and in particular cryptocurrency recovery. Both were able to combine that. That means we have somebody available to do that at all times, because that's something that's really, time is of the essence. When somebody loses money to our crypto scam, centralized administrative support in our purchasing payroll contracts, and then common hardware and software tools for case management. What this really has allowed us to do through a lot of this is have one cohesive team working on financial crimes across the state, but also it's allowed us, as was referenced, to fully maximize the resources that are intended to be combating insurance fraud, for example, under your committee, and financial crimes, to even have additional resources. And we've been able to identify resources through that where we'll be able to hire even additional agents and analysts to focus on the work that's important to the constituents. Our focus of this section, as is codified and required by statute, is to focus on fraud involving state-funded or administrative programs, insurance fraud, wage theft, and then traditional financial crimes. We also want to note that we work with local communities and law enforcement across the state of Minnesota. This section now, as it sits in its combined format, when it's fully staffed, has 46 full-time equivalents, one special agent in charge, four assistant special agents, which basically forms four teams, two that are fully dedicated to insurance fraud, one that has a mix, and the others that do a state program fraud, and the others, as I said, a traditional financial crimes, and then wage theft really kind of spans the spectrum depending on what the particular wage theft program is in that. We have seven criminal intelligence analysts, which are vitally important to these types of investigations because of the large volume of information and evidence that they analyze, and then two senior investigators. And again, they work statewide across Minnesota. This is how the budget is formulated in this, the insurance assessment that was referenced, and this is the base budget for this section, totaling about $13 million a year for those 46 FTEs. You have BCA state funding that was our traditional BCA state funding. The auto theft prevention grant, that is noted, it's now opened again this year. We're taking applications now that was referenced to combat auto theft across the state. And then other state agencies, the reference to that is we do have some contracts to combat fraud within the criminal aspect of fraud within some of those state agency programs, such as DEED and the Department of Human Services. Our investigative requests come really through four primary sources. The public tips that come into this are people that report fraud, insurance companies that are required by statute, as I know this committee is very familiar with, to report suspected crimes, law enforcement agencies, especially when it's a particularly complex financial crime, and other government regulatory entities. I should note here with that, part of that is there is a requirement under the statute for certain thresholds, in addition to the executive order, that state agencies must report, based on certain thresholds, any suspected criminal fraud to the BCA Financial Crimes and Fraud section. Give you some data just to understand exactly what we've been looking at. There were 2,889 case referrals last year into this section, consisting, and I'll get into the details in just a minute, of 538 allegations total, meaning what that means, just in case you're wondering, is some of those are allegations really that are either related as part of a larger case or the same type of allegation, and the majority of those are ongoing. As Commissioner Arnold noted, these do take a long time, so the referrals in a particular year often take years to investigate. We referred 39 cases to state and federal prosecutors. 33 of those were accepted, meaning accepted for prosecution. They had 14 plea agreements in the last year, some, as noted by the commissioner, from prior investigations from both teams. Charges were filed with an economic impact of more than $33 million, meaning that's documented loss in those cases that were filed across the spectrum, and then financial crimes that were related to identity theft. These are the five largest areas of suspected fraud that we took into this section in 2025. State program fraud, theft by swindle, false representation, and related crimes. These are the frauds that are as old as time, frankly, those types of crimes that we continue to see. Social Security disability fraud, we haven't talked about it much in this committee, but Social Security Administration funds a program that we've had BC agents assigned to for a long time that works with Minnesota Disability Determination to identify suspected fraud, both saving Minnesota taxpayers and federal taxpayers money in that process. Cryptocurrency-related fraud, and then identity theft, which is increasingly been a problem. Any of you that have got a call from your bank about your card being compromised, that's a form of identity theft. This is a chart that's in your packets as it just gives a little bit overview of where we're looking at over the last years in those categories and the number of case referrals from 2021 to 2025. State program fraud was a new category that we tracked beginning in 2025. That's why it's not available to the previous years out of this section, but the rest of it between the two different entities that combined into one, we were able to get the data going back quite some time. Financial crimes and fraud over the five-year case referral trend, just in this category alone, as you can see, it's remained relatively steady over the last 5 years. State program fraud in 2025, a little bit more information about that. There were 246 complaints into our required portal for reporting. Theft of public funds, theft against or fraud against programs administered by state government, fraud against individual Minnesotans, and then does not include Medicaid. So one nuance with this combination, just for awareness, is Medicaid fraud in particular, which we've heard a lot about, and I know you all are engaged in combating. We are working closely with MFUCU, which is Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is required by federal statute, and they are housed within the Attorney General's office. They have investigators and attorneys that work on that. We, both entities in the past, both Commerce Fraud Bureau and the BCA, have provided them limited assistance. We're looking for ways, as they look at more cases, to provide assistance to them, but it is within their primary jurisdiction. And that's what's referred here, that 46 cases referred to other agencies. It was Medicaid fraud primarily that was referred in that got referred back over to them. As of January 2026, state agencies, as I noted, are required to report losses of $10,000 or more. The reporting, and there's a report that'll be out to you soon that details all of this that's required in the statute, both all of our activities, but also state program fraud. There were 10 agencies that reported 652 incidents. 25 of those incidents, they were able to identify a loss amount, suspected of $4.22 million. The rest had unknown loss amounts. That could be for a variety of reasons. A, they're either unsure or they're still tallying it at the time of the reporting for that. And then they took administrative action on 645 of those 652 incidents. And again, I want to note for this, they are required to report criminal fraud. And when we think about fraud generally, it's waste, fraud, and abuse within state agency programs. So some of those may not have been reported to our financial crimes and fraud section. Getting into the insurance fraud, which I'm sure you have more of an interest in this particular committee, the five areas of largest insurance fraud reported to the section in 2025 were automobile insurance, which I know is a focus for many years in some of this, homeowners insurance, healthcare insurance, really in the private markets, Device protection has been a growing area of fraud. Insurance, these are incidents like your iPad or iPhone where they insure the device and they file a fraudulent claim or some sort of false related to that particular insurance, protection of those devices, or it could be a variety of things that are, as electronics become more expensive, it's obviously ripe for fraud, and then life insurance. This is a chart, and I won't go through all the numbers, but as you can see, and there'll be a graph here in a minute, it gives you the detailed breakdown of the reporting in by insurance, a crime, case referrals that come in. Again, just a note, you know, these are required to be reported by the various insurance companies under state statute if they suspect a crime, and these were the referrals that came in last year. There's a five-year trend. You can see there's a bit of a downward trend. I will note, as you're looking in here, automobile insurance is one that jumps off the page for me, that in 2021 there was about 300 higher levels. Hopefully the work that all of you do each and every day, I know the work here, I look at things like workers' compensation, that there's a lot of work that's done with the industry and trying to protect that. Hopefully there's a number of prevention efforts in the work that you're doing that actually drives some of these down. But as you can see, statistically, I wouldn't call that significant other than it's moving in the right direction. This case tips and tasks, what these are referrals into the section as a whole that are outside requests for either assistance, both driven internally by the BCA or also by outside law enforcement agencies for a variety. The reason you start to see this trend continuing to increase from my perspective sitting in this seat and why that is being driven up is it is increasingly complex, the different schemes and frauds that we're seeing. And we may not take the entire case, but they may need some guidance. Crypto is an example. It's expensive technology to be able to try to recover cryptocurrency once it's been stolen from a particular individual. And sometimes law enforcement, for obvious reasons, don't even know where to start. And so we see a number of calls in to us just providing technical assistance, and that's what this chart here reflects. I won't go through all these, but just a couple highlights that you'll see in the report, amongst many other that I'm seeing come in every day. But these are very typical of the type of that we see. This individual in February of 2025, a holdover, again, from a commerce case, was money laundering, wire fraud, charges 40 different fraudulent grant, loan contract applications. You'll see in our report, it spanned both private industry and government aid programs in that process, over $6 million individual that need to be held accountable. In June of this year, we had an individual charged with identity theft, theft by swindle, and insurance fraud, selling 127 Progressive car insurance policies over Facebook, was not licensed in Minnesota. This is something that I know Commerce has been tracking for different areas for individuals purporting to be insurance companies, something, and yet they aren't licensed or regulated, but that's another thing that we take a look at, and they're obviously working to protect the consumer from those sorts of things as they think they're buying, you know, insurance off the market when they are not. And then December, as noted, the Lutzen fire, that's another area that it was a strong partnership that existed prior to the combination that's even stronger now with the State Fire Marshal's Office being in the Department of Public Safety. And with that, I know I speak fast, so I always want to apologize for that, but I know you're busy people. We're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you to all of you, and Superintendent Evans, just to kind of help put some context on a few of the things that you spoke about, I was wondering if we could go back to slide 8, which the header on that says 2025 FCFS case overview, and it talks about 2,889 cases, and the second bullet point said there were 39 cases that 39 cases to state and federal prosecutors, and only 33 were accepted. Why did the other six fail to meet prosecution standards?
Chair Driscoll, members of the committee, I don't have the specifics on the six. I certainly could get them for you. But anytime these cases, for a variety of reasons, especially in the fraud arena, we have to prove a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not unusual in some of these types of cases for a variety of reasons that prosecutors would not accept all of them if there's a problem with proving a particular element of the crime for there. I don't know exactly those. I'd be happy to get those six and get the specific details, but there's often a variety. It's not unusual. Our perspective at the BCA, I should note, is if we feel something is important enough to open a criminal investigation and put the time and effort into it, we want a prosecutor to review it, even though there's times we get into cases, which happens in all cases across the BCA, where we just get to a place where we believe criminal activity is occurring, but for a variety of reasons, we just can't get over that threshold of proving that case beyond a reasonable doubt. But I'd be happy if you'd like that to look into those six.
Yeah, just something that I noticed, and then when you talk about 39 referred and 33 accepted, but what was the issue with the other six? And then I have two other things, and I've got some member questions we'll get to, and we'll certainly get back to some other ones that I have. And I'm going to just ask you to turn, if you would, to page 17 in the handout. Leads requests for investigative assistance 2021 through 2025. It looks to me like in about a four-year period of time, we just have had an exponential, and maybe you can provide some guidance and breakdown on this, and maybe Commissioner Arnold can talk about some of this too. I don't know if this is a blended statistic now from what had happened when Commerce had this and it's been blended into your numbers, or these are standalone numbers and contacts that your agencies had. But it seems to me that in a one-year period of time, we've had almost a doubling of inquiries or reports on fraud-related activities, and that seems to be kind of in the news quite regularly. Maybe you could shed some light on that, or maybe Commissioner Arnold can help with some of that too. I'm just looking to see what is in that number, and then maybe again a little bit of a review of why that number spiked so much from 24 to 25.
Yeah, Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee, that spike I think reflects a couple of things that you're seeing. But as noted, as we're going through this, we have seen a significant increase. This would be a combined, so we have a lot more people. So they're getting calls from law enforcement. We ask them to log this in to be able to chart this out for you, and so we're collecting more data to really help understand for all of you in this process as we look at, as opposed to, you know, in 2021, I don't think it was, certainly wasn't 1,300, but I believe it's probably more than 8, but we've been more specific with our agents to really track when a law enforcement agency, for example, calls them, even with technical assistance, so we can really understand that. I do think there's been more, I don't think, there have been more referrals in for suspected fraud across the spectrum of everything that we're doing. That's a good thing. It's also driven some of that spike that you're seeing in this particular chart when you're looking at that. But it also is reflective of what we see as increasingly complex fraud schemes where local law enforcement might get something and they just don't even know what to do. And so we may not accept that particular case, but we want to provide guidance each and every time. We certainly, one of the mantras of us at the BCA, I'm certainly true of the Fraud Bureau as well previously, is that we want to assist our partners in each and every way we can to help them keep their community safe. So there has been a spike not just in state program fraud, but all types of fraud that we've seen across the spectrum. One thing that I really enjoy being in front of your committee, and as I've learned a lot more about insurance fraud, and it's not new to any of you, but the very complex nature and that they're seeing as I attend meetings and talk to them, the schemes are constantly evolving, and I do think it's leading to additional referrals to us. And but this number, I don't know the commissioner has the actual number. It is but the whole team as a whole and what they're receiving.
Commissioner Arnold?
Chair O'Driscoll, I'll say if you look back at the Fraud Bureau reports that we put out annually, Commerce, that the case referrals kind of fluctuated over time, and so we can share the graph. I don't have it able to share like this, but they sort of fluctuated up and down over time, and I think with the combination, you're likely to see that there are, like, you see something in one area and it's connected to something in another area, because, you know, as Superintendent Evans said, these are rarely like one type of crime. Like, criminals aren't saying like, oh, I'm only going to do insurance fraud. You know, maybe they have a scheme, but they have larger schemes and they have other kinds of things. And so I think we'd have to dig in a little bit more to figure out exactly what the data are showing. But just like historically, we saw trends that would sort of go up and down, often in line with trends that we're seeing either with referrals from local law enforcement or other things. As Superintendent Evans mentioned, sometimes we'd get things that they just didn't know how to handle, and so they knew someone at our unit, and then they would refer that in. And then other times there would be like specific kinds of schemes that were gaining more popularity, and then we'd, you know, then companies would get to be savvy about those, and then they would refer those in. And so I think it reflects not just kind of an overall awareness of the kinds of fraud and all of the causes that the Superintendent Evans mentioned, but also just that there are kind of natural fluctuations in the way that markets are working and the kinds of schemes that criminals will run. And so, you know, this data, I think we can maybe follow up on the specific case, but in general, as there is evolution in criminal behavior, there are changes in trends that you see in the data, and I think this probably reflects that as well.
Very quickly, Superintendent.
Yeah, I apologize, Chair. I just want to be clear because it's a clarification that I think will be helpful, and I did not explain this very well for this particular chart. The fluctuations, as the Commissioner noted, those are, you know, cases, referrals going in. Tips and tasks are things that are, for us, that are lesser than a full case. So this gets a little bit into the weeds for how we do business, but these are usually like an actual task as opposed to a full investigation that we're doing. So again, it might be just assistance in trying to recover a crypto, but we don't actually have a case open. We would document it in this category. That's where those kind of one-off assistance are being documented in this particular chart. I just want to make sure that's clear.
Commissioner, the last thing, and I'm Superintendent Evans. You mentioned no less than about a half a dozen times cryptocurrency and things that are related to that. Believe it or not, very soon this committee is going to be taking up some issues related to crypto. And before we dismiss you today, I would like to have you share some things that we would need to take into consideration as a group that would be involved in regulating that industry that might be helpful for us in our deliberations. So we're going to leave you some time at the end for that comment. And with that, I've got four member questions. We're going to start with Representative Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here today. This was really helpful. I also just want to express my gratitude for all that the Commissioner and the Superintendent did over the summer to support all members and as we kind of try to move forward here. I am hoping to just get a little bit more clarity between pages 12 and 8 on the PowerPoint here. So page 12 is state program fraud referrals. Are those the ones that come to the BCA from other departments? Is out of that 2,889 case referrals, or I'm just trying to understand how those numbers connect.
Commissioner, or excuse me, Superintendent Evans, yeah, I keep giving you a, I don't know if it's promotion or demotion or a lateral move, but my apologies. Superintendent Evans.
Probably a demotion, not in the sense of the true word, but in terms of a job that's a very difficult one. Thank you for the question, Chair Driscoll and Representative. It's a subset of the 2,800. So it's a great question. Those 246, they are required reporting by state agencies, meaning just state of Minnesota agencies that are both on 2501 executive order and the statute that was passed last year, which is a combination. I share that because 2501 executive order remains in effect. The threshold is lower. It's any suspected criminal activity. We do have thresholds that were passed in the statute. So that includes everything that's reported by state agencies, which is a subset of that 2800 number.
Representative Cadiz, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarity. I appreciate that. So just looking at, again, page 8 and that 2,000, almost 3,000 case referral number, only 259 investigations were initiated, and that you said that 538 allegations kind of were connected to those 259 investigations. So that's a lot of referrals that don't actually end up going, like, continuing on into an investigation process. And I guess I'm just curious, what is the process between taking some of those referrals, like maybe the initial review that you or your staff do in order to determine whether or not that is something that necessitates a full investigation?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative. The intake is similar for all. Like, I look back over this, and we had some of these questions on the initial combination as that there's a lot of referrals that come into the system, but that they then work through a process that they look at solvability factors, getting into law enforcement. Are we actually going to be able to solve, you know, this particular crime based on the information that we have? Is there additional evidence that we'd be able to gather in the process or not, depending depending on what it is, what type of information is initially reported into that. We've had conversations ongoing. I know this team with the Department of Commerce continues to work together with the special investigations units in the insurance industry to get better information coming into the portal to begin with. In that process, I tell you from being at some of their national meetings, this is an ongoing discussion with states across the country, how to ensure the information coming in on the right, the beginning is actionable in that process. But as you can see, that's not in the state program fraud, it's not all that different. So it might be something, and just to give an example, somebody says my neighbor's committing, you know, state program fraud. We do an initial review of it. There's no actionable information in that process, or you talk to that person, they don't actually have any information that is actionable by us to further that investigation. So that's a triage process. Both state program fraud, the Commerce Fraud Bureau had individuals that do triage on the front end that came over. They continue to do that work today. We're doing the same thing. We just hired back an agent. We have mandatory retirement in the law enforcement ranks for state law enforcement. We're hiring back one of those on the state program fraud so that he can be our triage to really do that. Our continual goal is to increase the number of cases you take for investigation, but there's only so much we can do when we don't have information that we can actually act upon.
Representative Tizzatone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for that. I think it's really helpful. And of course, you know, I speak for myself, but I don't think that many of my colleagues would mind me saying that we all and you all, you know, put our blood, sweat, and tears into this work, into making sure that Minnesotans have access to the programs that we allocate funding for. And you know, personally, as the co-chair of the Children and Families Committee, and I know the BCA has worked in partnership after some of the most recent allegations of fraud in the child care assistance program, I spend time away from my own children making sure that Minnesotans can afford and access the care that their kids need. So it's really, really frustrating when we see those dollars going to fraudsters and that people are taking advantage of the programs that we have set up to help the people who need it the most. And I think that when we look at this process, I want to make sure that our tax dollars are being spent wisely, not only for the investigations that you and your staff are doing, but then that they're getting to the end user in the right way. So if we have got spurious claims coming in from folks who are just trying to, you know, perhaps place blame that is unwarranted, on those people, I want to make sure that you are able to kind of get to the bottom of that quickly, not spend a bunch of department time on finding out those potentially false or spurious claims, and then ultimately focus on the fraudsters who are doing the real harm. So I appreciate your partnership.
Thank you, Representative Gutierrez-Watoon. Our next question comes from Representative Dotseth, followed by Representative Elkins. Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members for being here, commissioners, and Superintendent, appreciate that you're here today, and I appreciate all the hard work that you do. Question would probably be more directed towards the Superintendent Evans and Commissioner Arnold. With the merger of services from Commerce over to BCA, have you sensed that, have you experienced any operational hiccups in the process as far as this merger, and do you have any documentation of that as well?
You asked for both Commissioner Arnold and Superintendent Evans. I think we'll start with Superintendent Evans since he's the receiver of the integration assignment. Superintendent
Chair,
Evans.
Driscoll and Representative, you know, with any combination, certainly on the very front end, I don't know that hiccups would be the word, but you need to take two teams and merge them into one, and we've been working very diligently both with Commerce and that team over the last year to do that. You know, I stopped in just as a example of this yesterday. They have a meeting that's an ongoing with that team, as I know it's a large team, and I sensed no hiccups in that particular room with them. The teams are definitely working well together. It's one big team now. It's not two different teams working on the same stuff that's been merged in that process. And, you know, it took us a while, not a while, it takes some time to really make sure you have the structure right. The statute, for example, requires us to ensure that the insurance fraud assessment goes to nothing other than insurance fraud. So creating the right structure with the teams, the four teams that we put together to ensure that we're always in compliance with that. But no, I haven't really experienced hiccups. In fact, we found efficiencies that have allowed us to hire additional people to focus on this particular crimes that we're looking at right now, both in the general fund and also in the insurance assessment itself, to put further resources towards towards that. We've been working to not only give the report that we give to you every year, but working to work with the industry to make sure that they have a better line of sight into the work that we're doing. We have those reports flowing now and others. So, I mean, if there's specifics, I'd happy, but I haven't really experienced any specific hiccups as a term from my perspective.
Commissioner Arnold, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm happy to share from the department's perspective, so Representative Dodseth and Chair Driscoll. You know, I think some of the things that our teams were really worried about in the beginning, particularly access to information between the two agencies, we were able to work through. And so sometimes those things take time. Like, you know, there's somebody owns a system, so you have to, like, talk to the system. There's security around that system. You know, you have to make sure that you have the right access. Like, those are things that are just – like processes that take time to make sure that, like, you know, we're communicating and saying, yes, it is okay that, you know, this team has access, they should have access, they need access so that they can do the referrals. I don't know that that kept any, like, slowed any cases or anything, but I think that those are the kinds of things that, I don't know that they're surprising, but, you know, you, like, I wouldn't have thought, oh, of course there are security protocols around a system that has a whole bunch of insurance fraud data. So, like, you know, you had to work through those security protocols with the new agency and made sure they make sense. Those are the kinds of things that are kind of normal in any sort of, like, transition or any sort of process. But they do take time, and so I think that those are the kinds of things that we saw as we were working through the issues. Again, I, you know, as Superintendent Evans said, I wouldn't consider them hiccups, but they're – there are things you have to do and there are processes, and you find out that there are things that you need as you go through the process, and you just address them as you go. And so, and sometimes they take time. I don't think that it took, you know, time that was detrimental to the team, but those are the kinds of things that came up just as we were working through the process.
Representative Dodson, follow-up.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Chair. Appreciate your response. I think you find that this committee has a responsibility to make sure that there's accountability and that there's transparency in this process. Maybe a follow-up question would be is, have you seen any movement of maybe investigators that normally would have been directed towards insurance and real estate, et cetera, and moved into other areas that normally wouldn't have been moved into before?
I believe that's most appropriate for Superintendent Evans.
Yeah, Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Dossett, no, the short answer is no. We do have, there's been some opportunities. I think we have currently one agent that came from Commerce Fraud, had an interest in being on our crime scene team, and so she's been on that team and is a member of that team, but that's a part-time ancillary duty in that, and we pay that out of general fund when we're doing that. So also, I've seen really probably more the opposite. I think I referenced in the comments, we're out right now across the Twin Cities working on a human trafficking, financial fraud-related case that would have been done separately in the past, that they're one team out now that we are able to further our resources. But we haven't moved anybody that did that work. I think I meant what I said when I was in front of this committee before. The expertise of those agents doing financial crimes is vitally important to us. This is fraud of all sorts is vitally important to us as an organization, and those individuals have stayed there. As I suspected, there are some individuals that do that work that are asking for to go do something else because it was a career aspiration of theirs. The way we work when we do that is we often, if they're a good performing agent, we're going to allow them to take that new assignment, but we do it once we have in a position where we have somebody to backfill them so we don't lose out on the work that we're already doing. But nobody's been reassigned or moved anywhere.
Before I go to Representative Elkins' question, I just wanted to maybe just ping off of what Representative Dodson was talking about. Since we last met in a forum like this, I would say that there were at least three major instances that had occurred in the state of Minnesota. In June, we lost Melissa and Mark Hortman in a very devastating assassination, and almost lost Senator Hoffman and his wife Yvonne as well. And then in late summer, early September, we had an unfortunate situation occurring at a parochial school in Minneapolis. And then, again, I'm not getting into the politics of this, but I'm just talking about three different events. There was some disagreement about how to deal with federal enforcement in the state of Minnesota, and your agency and like have been involved in that. My question our area of jurisdiction, our area of protection is, were any of those agents that would have otherwise been nested in the Department of Commerce pulled off of commerce fraud-related activities and assigned permanently or temporarily to any of the above-mentioned situations that occurred in the state of Minnesota?
Chair O'Driscoll, it's a good question. It's been asked to me a few different times, so I don't know where the information's been coming from. The only one that I'm aware of is that crime scene agent that was at the Annunciation School shooting. The rest of them continued their work. Frankly, their skill set and their expertise isn't always some of those events that you're referencing. In particular, the most recent one, I have had to reassign people because of the significant challenges faced with us with the lack of information sharing as we conduct officer-involved shooting investigations. Those individuals came from our violent crime team. They did not come from any of our financial crimes investigators at all. So that team has remained intact. As I think this committee would know, they've got their hands full with their own work. We need to make sure that they're focused on the financial crimes work. That's important not only to this committee, but other committees of doing the other traditional financial crimes. So no.
Thank you. Representative Elkins, followed by Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my comments or questions kind of build on the ones that Representative Cortese of Wattoon was mentioning. I think in this committee, when the governor, you know, made that move, there was a lot of trepidation in this committee about exactly the kinds of questions you were raising just now. But I think that with time and with what the things that we're hearing from Superintendent Evans today, I would have to conclude that it's actually worked out pretty well. And I think we're seeing the advantages of having all of our investigative resources kind of co-located, economies of scale, but, you know, more importantly, the combination of all of these people is actually improving our overall investigative capacity. And so I think it's worked out well. And I what I really wanted to say is that, you know, I think, you know, as a member of the Fraud Prevention Committee as well, you know, we've been having some discussions, you know, about this. And Representative Norris and I have, you know, spoken with Superintendent Evans informally about, you know, where should a state IG be located? What's the most logical place where we could, where such a person could investigate crimes against the government most effectively? And we kind of come to the conclusion that the state IG should be located, you know, kind of co-located with the BCA, so that that new state AG could take advantage of all of the BCA's resources instead of trying to create a separate specialized unit, as had been done with this financial crimes unit in commerce. In our conversations, especially conversations I've had with Representative Norris, we recognize that there have been, you know, complaints about retaliation against whistleblowers and the like. So it's important that you know, people have evidence to bring to the attention of criminal investigators, have a place where they can go, where they can feel safe against retaliation, which is one of the reasons why I think it does make sense to have a state inspector general. And I think that the by law, many of the agencies, including DHS, DCYF, education, have to have their own inspector generals. But if those inspector generals at the agency level reported to the state IG instead of the agency head, it would eliminate a lot of the conflicts of interest that an agency IG has right now. And so I want to conclude just by saying that the current proposal that Representative Norris is trying to get in front of us related to the organization of the state IG reflects those, you know, investigations and conversations. And I would just ask people on the folks, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, to take his proposal seriously, because it really is offered in good faith. And I, you know, please look at Representative Norris's proposal in that light, in terms of the practicality and effectiveness of the unit. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And Representative Heinzman, followed by Representative Cha. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, we had quite a robust discussion last year, I believe, when the governor made his announcement that he was going to be moving the CFB to the BCA. And there was, I think, a lot of, I think the word was used, trepidation about that decision. And there may be those that feel that the outcomes have been something that we can demonstrate and we can show that that was a good decision. I'll just say that this issue, and when people hear the word fraud right now in Minnesota and even across this entire country, we're having a civil conversation today. If a lot of those people were here from my community that come to me and they see what has happened here in Minnesota, it wouldn't be a very civil conversation. And if there is demonstrable or measurable evidence that you can offer today or provide to us, and it was nice to have the slides that were made available, but I'm not sure that I'm over my trepidation yet. And I think that most Minnesotans would say, well, okay, I'm not sure what the governor's intent was. If, you know, I have this example or that example that I'm learning about, and that wasn't apparently identified and stopped. And if there's some if there's some actual data that could have been brought to us to show that this change has been effective, I'd sure love to hear it. I think that most of our constituents would also love to have that presented to them in a way that really does prove that decision to move the CFB to the BCA was the right choice.
Superintendent Evans, comments?
Yeah, Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Heisman, I hear you, and I certainly appreciate comments on both, and, you know, my continued goal here is to earn the trust of this committee that I anticipate being back in front of, on a regular basis to answer those questions. To your point, I have said often when it comes to state program fraud, which I think is probably your constituents that's most front of mind when it comes to this, and I hear this loud and clear. I'm a part of a lot of different meetings across the enterprise discussing a lot of these different issues from Inspector General and then the BCA continuing to those criminal investigations. I want to be clear in front of this committee. When it comes to criminal investigations, it's too late. We'll hold people accountable. We're going to put them, you know, in jail where they belong in that process, and we have and continue to do that out of this section, out of both teams that did this. But there's another layer and element that needs to be baked in that you're having many debates about, and that has to do with the prevention of this to begin with. Medicaid fraud accounts, as I've seen, a year of the data that's come in, and we have a report that'll be out to you soon outlining this with the agencies reporting the fraud that are in there, remains the largest bulk of the reporting that I see coming in to this tip line. There's other fraud in state government programs, but it tends to be limited in the amount of loss, and we're able to often identify those people and hold them accountable. This team, though, focusing on this, that's what we'll continue to, you know, show you and demonstrate over time that's there. I don't expect your constituents to feel any different. I think all of us should be outraged by anybody stealing any of our money. We all work hard for the money that we have, and anybody that's a fraudster or steals their funds is in many ways one of the people that need to be held accountable for that. So, you know, this, I think there is a lot of data in this, but you're going to see it in the report as well that we'll be able to give, and I'm always happy to give deeper dive. And it's my continued goal that I'm not asking you to trust me. I'm working to demonstrate that trust over time with that from the BCA that I know may take more than one hearing just 1 year into this.
We have another presentation that we need to hear from today, and we've been at this for just about an hour, and I am good with this because this is important to the committee. But I do have Representative Heinzman, if he has a follow-up, and then I have three other members who are on here. And I do think for the benefit of the committee, it's important that we have Superintendent Evans talk about crypto, since we do have that coming up for the benefit of this committee where we're trying to make some decisions on here. Representative Heinzman, did you have a follow-up? Because then we're going to go to Representative Cha. And then we've got Representative Kreshaw on the list as well. Representative Heinzman?
Mr. Chair, I would just comment, Mr. Superintendent, that report that you're referencing, I really hope that it has the data that I think all of our constituents are looking for, that people of Minnesota expect to see real evidence that the governor's decision to move the CFB is easily shown to be an effective tool, and if it isn't, it needs to move back.
Superintendent Evans, comment, thought? Okay, just want to make sure that you get a chance to respond if you would like. With that, we're going to go to Representative Cha, then it's Representative Khrushchev. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. My question is about cryptocurrency. And so, you know, it's a huge concern across the state, especially with seniors and commuting, and especially in my district. Can you give some example of the cryptocurrency fraud schemes that are happening, and then also talk about some areas where you've had success?
Superintendent Evans.
Yeah, so when Chair Driscoll and Representative Cha, it is a growing concern for us just in general with cryptocurrency. Some of the concerns that we have, and I think your reference it was seniors, I struggle to understand cryptocurrency, and I've had probably as many briefings or more than anybody sitting around this table. And so, you know, being an alternative, you know, money form that we're working through, there's a number of pieces that come with that, and the lack of regulation in a lot of ways is what creates some challenges with that. When we reference seniors, I'll give a success example, but also recognizes the challenge. One of our agents, not all that long ago in the last year, walked in, was getting gas on their way into work and saw seniors feeding $100 bills into a crypto kiosk. And it was one of these examples where they were being defrauded, a number of different schemes. We could go through a lot of them. This was one of the common ones where, you know, their grandchild was in jail in this scenario and they needed to feed money in this particular area. And it was thousands of dollars going in. When that money's gone, that money's gone. And so the kiosks in particular are causing a lot of concern. I know there's a large spectrum of them, control of them, and some oversight would be very effective in a variety of ways. Some communities have banned them. There's a number of different things you could contemplate in this process. That the recovery of the funds is very difficult for us. So okay, there's everything from you might have seen in Matamidi, I'm going to lose track of the time, but in the last year, an individual lost a significant amount of funds in the millions and millions of dollars when he was targeted through a data breach that identified people that had cryptocurrency accounts that are large amounts, and he was taken hostage and robbed and forced to transfer his crypto throughout the day. We recovered only a fraction of that money. And so this is an individual that invested, had millions and millions of dollars, and he lost the bulk of his funding in that. So that's another area, the recovery of those tools from there. And then just in terms of challenges on investigative, it is complicated. And so to have the expertise and the tools to do the recovery is incredibly expensive. So it's expensive for us to maintain the technology. We have licenses for right now for four licenses, as I mentioned, four agents that have this expertise. But it is a challenge for them in that process. But the unregulation, I don't know, Commissioner, if you have additional, but the there's a variety of challenges with crypto currently.
Commissioner, would you like to comment? I know that your agency may be here to testify on
yes.
that topic when it comes up on our agenda. But
Chair Driscoll and Representative Cha, I'll just add in. So we license crypto kiosks, and we've worked with this committee in the past to put some limits on it. What we find is that those limits are like wholly ineffective in preventing fraud, and particularly to crypto kiosks. There's just not a lot of valid reasons that you would use one, and we will get into that in our testimony. I'll save that for my team to walk through all of that. But I just want to emphasize that is like we have a, you know, there's the fraud part, you know, and then you try to do the licensing part, and there's the civil side. And I think we've tried to put some rails around that, and I think it's just not working very well. And that's a particular avenue where, like, it's just all fraud, basically. And so that's something that we're really excited to be talking to the committee about. And, you know, our department is going to one of our department bills will be a ban, too. So we'll be here. I know that's one that Representative Perriman and Cagle are working on too. So we're really happy that this is a focus of the committee, and really excited to be working on that, because that's one where it's just like it's seniors feeding cash into Bitcoin accounts that they never see again.
Representative Chatter, do you have a quick follow-up, sir?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up, maybe a comment. You know, some things I'm hearing a lot is these rug pulls and the romance, right? The pig brook churning, right? And those are some of the things that I've heard. So when you do come back, please, you know, touch on those topics. So thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Hang on, we got one more question.
Representative Kreisha, and then we're going to, having no other member questions, we're going to then move to Chair Cagle for her final thoughts on the subject as well. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. And just a quick personal note, Superintendent Evans, the last time you were here and you and I talked over there, since that moment, your credibility with me has continued to go up. Every time I've seen you in action and seen the presentations you've done, your authenticity and character and genuineness has been on display. So I want to thank you for that. You also said something, a couple things that kind of sparked my comment, one of them which is, you're right, once it's time for prosecution and sentencing and all that, it's already too late. And I also want to thank you for using some of the talking points we've used a long time, which is waste, fraud, and abuse. Those words are coming around 360. And I don't say that with insincerity. I understand the very tough job you're in, and I'm making light of the comment that I'm about to make, which is, to my colleagues on the other side, we told you so many, many, many times. And thank you for falling over yourselves now and claiming that you care about fraud and your great Facebook posts. But for many years, all we heard was, well, there's really not that much fraud. Well, it's loopholes. Well, it's vague. Well, it's this. Now we have been telling you, and as Superintendent Evans said, it was the prevention. It was the prevention, and it was where this administration fell down time after time after time. We can herald the dam repairers, those that are trying to plug it. But the dam builder fell down on this. And it's the dollars that went out the door that hurt families, that will never get back, that were the real damages. So we told you so. Thank you.
With that, we're going to go to Representative Kegel for her thoughts, and then I'm just going to give you a chance for our Superintendent Evans to maybe give us some things about crypto that we didn't cover in Representative Chau's comments and the like. So Representative and Co-Chair Kegel.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to kind of just echo the thank you for all the support that all of you have given us over the past, you know, few months. It's been really a tough time for us. But just to kind of, you know, piggyback on what Representative Kreisha was talking about, there has been a systematic defunding of public services run by public employees. We have seen 30 years of GOP policies to privatize government. When we privatize government, the incentive for these workers is profit, and there's absolutely no accountability to the taxpayers. And so if we want to get, you know, if we want to get real about fraud, we need to talk about how, who's serving the people and who they're accountable to. People who serve, or private entities have boards, have shareholders, that's who they're reporting to, not us, the taxpayers. And so by systematically starving government, this is a policy choice that has happened over the past 30 years, is that we systematically starve government so that they are unable to do the enforcement that they need to do, and weakening the accountability to taxpayers. So privatization of government services has made it ripe for fraud. And so that's what we're seeing right now, and it's a result of public policy choices that have been made. And so we need to make sure that taxpayer dollars are accountable to taxpayers, and that these employees that are running these services are accountable to taxpayers. And so I want to thank you. I also would, you know, love to see some of the statistics on corporate fraud and what's happening at the highest levels, because the system is tilted towards big money. And it's not a GOP or Democrat thing. This is a top versus bottom. And the bottom is losing out. And so sorry for getting a little fiery, but you know, sometimes somebody sparks a little bit in you. And so I want to thank you for all the work that you have done and continue to do to make sure that taxpayer dollars are going to the places that and the services that we want them to go to. Thank you.
And Superintendent Evans, if you want to take just a couple moments to talk about crypto, and then we're going to use the last 35 minutes that we have. to take up the other item on here.
Yeah.
Brevity is important, but again, we may have you back at some point in the future to talk about this issue again or other issues that come before the committee, because collectively no one wants fraud, and this committee certainly wants to protect its territory and give the resources and the support necessary to not have fraudulent activities happen on our watch. So, Superintendent Evans, if you want to comment on crypto.
Yeah, thank you for those comments, Chair Driscoll, and we share that common goal and happy to be in front of this committee or make subject matter experts available at any time on these. You know, as the Commissioner said, the kiosks in particular cause a lot of concern with not only our communities, but I would tend to agree with that we haven't seen them to be of value to individuals in particular that are doing this legitimately. They tend to be trading and investing in cryptocurrency. I'll note the opaqueness of the crypto world in general creates a lot of challenges and makes it ripe for fraud and actually hiding criminal proceeds just in general because of the way that the system in general works for cryptocurrency. And so it's been a challenge. It will continue to be a challenge. And then recovery for victims, as I've noted already, becomes a significant challenge, and people lose, you know, keys or the inability to recover that, the lack of insured funds in that process. There's just a number of things, and I would welcome, and the experts are the regulators here. We're again there when it becomes challenging, but crypto, trying to align it in ways that, you know, tend to align more with our monetary policies for some of the other regulated industries would be a big benefit to ensuring that fraud is not endemic and that it's not used as a cover for criminal proceeds. I think, frankly, at times when you see significant swings in crypto prices, you're seeing large-scale criminal enterprises moving money around.
Superintendent Evans, we will invite you to participate in the meeting if you'd like to, that we talk about crypto if you feel it's important and there's other things that you, or submit written testimony for this committee's consideration if you have some things that we should take into consideration while determining what's the best approach for public policy. So, Chair Davids, we were done with member questions, but
not a question.
Go ahead.
Just as we switch bills here, and maybe I'm too early. Just as we swear, I keep my track of things that are said, and both sides got a little partisan today. But my favorite statement was Representative Cagle saying, "We have starved government." That's like saying Greg Davids has been starved.
Well, with that, Mr. Chair, we're going to thank our testifiers and the time that they spent here today and the update that was provided. As Representative Elkins makes his way to the testifying table, again, a little bit of background. Members, there is going to be a task force report in here. We're going to go through the highlights today. This is still a work in progress, and there's also a slide deck. And the background on this for the team is last year we had as a Commerce Committee in the House determined that through consultation with a lot of folks that the cost of insurance is going up and limited places where you can get insurance for things like homeowners associations and or rental properties, the multifamily apartments and the like, as well as other areas. And so we created a task force, and that task force spent quite a bit of summer and fall going through the issues, and it was chaired by Representative Elkins, and he is going to be the one who is going to report to us, as he was the chair of this task force, and it was his idea that we were moving forward. And Representative Elkins, again, working through the highlights of this, and we'll take as much testimony as we can today, and if necessary, we will look at coming back to this topic because it's not a one-and-done topic. This is something that's going to need this committee's attention and work over a longer period of time than we just have this session to get to the right answers and the right solutions. I'm continuing to talk to provide Representative Elkins some more time to be able to get his presentation set up here. I'm just about out of words, so I hope he's about ready. And again, for the record, Representative Elkins is also the co-vice chair of this committee, and so welcome you to the role of testifying and reporting on the task force. When you are ready, proceed.
Okay, hold on a second here. Here we go. Oh, it's working. Okay.
You're good. Sometimes the magic works and doesn't. Sometimes it doesn't. Today we're in good shape. So,
Representative Elkins, we will ask you to pull the microphone closer. There you go.
There we go. Okay. Okay. So the background of this, and Chair O'Driscoll said this was my idea. Actually, it was the idea of one of my constituents who came to me with a complaint that their condo homeowners association was almost impossible for them to get property damage insurance after the 2023 storms. In 2023, we had like three separate hailstorms, each of which generated over $1 billion in claims. And the increasing frequency of wind and hail damage in the whole upper Midwest, starting in the early 2020s, made the whole insurance company, insurance industry, gun shy about providing that coverage. And so premiums, skyrocketed. The insurers were, in fact, losing money on their property damage insurance, and a lot of especially older condominiums, older apartment buildings were having trouble getting coverage at all. So this particular constituent told me that for his condo association, the only way they could get property damage insurance was by going to Lloyd's of London, and they paid four times what they paid the previous year. I was hearing stories of people just couldn't get insurance. Their association couldn't get insurance at all for the owners of especially older apartment buildings. The premium increases for this coverage was jeopardizing their mission of being able to provide affordable housing for people with low incomes. And so the problem was becoming pretty pervasive, and would say also that to the extent that people were able to get coverage for these kinds of properties, they were typically not getting it from what's called the help me, Chair, just what's the you have the surplus lines and the admitted market. So the admitted market is the standard insurance products that you can buy easily off the shelf. All of the products that are available, standard products in the admitted market, are subject to Commerce Department oversight, so they're well, I would say, regulated but overseen. But when you have to go from the standard products in the admitted market to the surplus lines market, the surplus lines market is basically unregulated or minimally regulated. And it's basically bespoke in insurance. It's a custom package that has been put together for you because none of the standard products will work in your situation, or there aren't any insurers who are able or willing or able to offer you coverage through one of their standard products. So this was really the driver for this. What are there? We know kind of that climate change, however one might. Argue that it's caused, is certainly the ultimate root cause here. We're looking for other exacerbating factors and found some. So the task force's charge was to look at the issues, provide recommendations related to insurance affordability for single-family housing, common interest communities, and multifamily rental housing, and for preventing disruptions or loss to the development, preservation, and long-term sustainability of our housing infrastructure, and to identify recommendations to strengthen and stabilize the homeowners and commercial property insurance industry. So the task force membership, which if you look at this, I don't know if it was presented. No, it wasn't printed the way I asked. But there, if you look at the slide presentation online and look at the notes, if you print it out or view it in notes view, you'll see a lot of the detailed language from the statute itself, and that's true of most of these slides. So, but we had a well-balanced task force, members of the insurance industry and representatives of the insured, including the condominium associations, affordable housing, and the like, along with legislators, the Department of Commerce, and various subject matter experts from the construction industry and related. So it was usually LCC task forces have a member from each caucus, the four caucuses, but Chair O'Driscoll didn't trust you slackers, so I was the only one from the House. And the Senate got really curious because they had one seat, and so Senator Dames and Senator Seeberger had to take turns on the committee. So we met 9 times between September and early February, heard testimony from over 24 different parties. And to keep things organized, each meeting was devoted to the discussion of one or more of the subject areas that we identified as ripe for discussion at our earliest meetings. So we were looking at risk mitigation and property resilience and the effect on insurance, effect of liability laws on insurance costs, and whether tort reform could reduce cost. Consumer issues like minimum notice for coverage changes, including enforcement and oversight, public reporting of aggregated data related to insurance plan costs and coverage. So one of the issues we discovered is that insurance industry data is subject to a considerable lag because it's generally not reported to regulators until claims are settled, which can take an extended period of time. So for much of our deliberations, we're only able to see data through, say, 2022, when a lot of the data that was most relevant was from that 2023 calendar year. So we looked at current state-supported insurance program and potential to expand the program to a catastrophic reinsurance fund and self-insured pool. So the insurer of last resort in Minnesota is called the FAIR Plan, F-A-I-R. And it's a plan that it's funded from assessments against the insurers. So it is a cross-subsidy program. But right now it's only available to like single-family homes, and there hasn't been that much need for it. So in a typical year, there might be a couple of a dozen homeowners tops that are have to resort to the FAIR plan to get their insurance company insurance because it is more expensive than any standard product that you would get on the regulated market. But the FAIR plan does not cover the kinds of properties that have been most impacted, by this problem, including homeowners associations and apartment buildings. So that's one of the things we looked at. And then we also looked at factors that are increasing claim costs, including but not limited to post-loss contractors, fraudulent claims, climate inflation, and discontinued building materials. So part of the issues that we were discovering as part of this is that just building materials, just, shingles are just everything that is involved in repairing a home after it receives storm damage is beginning more and more expensive. Labor costs are becoming more expensive. And those kinds of factors are also impacting the cost of insurance as well. And then we also examine regulatory factors that might increase insurance costs or decrease access. And kind of miscellaneously, other areas that would strengthen and stabilize the homeowner and commercial insurance industry. So we came up with about a little over half dozen specific recommendations. And I would say that this we had a it was a really good task force. We had a wide variety of perspectives. I would say that we had all of the perspectives we needed at the table. Everyone was very forthcoming with the insurance they could provide. And if you go to the task force's website on the legislative LCC pages, we had really good testimony. If you're interested in digging into this, the presentations that were made to the committee were excellent. In addition, we had all kinds of really good background materials that became part of the record. There's a whole reference section organized according to the subject areas that I had on the previous slide. Anyone who's interested in digging into a particular aspect of this in more detail, there's some amazing resources available on the committee's website. So the first recommendation was that we asked the administrators of the Minnesota FAIR Plan to examine the feasibility of offering coverage for markets such as condominiums and affordable markets in addition to its existing coverage of single-family homes. So it's really the older condominiums and older apartment buildings that are most severely impacted by what's happening right now. Just because the cost of repairing those kinds of properties should they endure storm damage. the legislature should fund the implementation of the Strengthened Minnesota Homes Insurance Discount Program that was passed by the legislature in 2023. So this is a program that we passed in 2023, and it's essentially an insurance industry program where if you beef up your roof to better withstand the kind of storms that we have here, you get a discount on your homeowner's insurance. I talked to a constituent who took advantage of this and said that the payback period on his strengthened roof in terms of reductions and insurance payback period was like 6 or 7 years for him. So it was looking to be a good investment. But in 2023, when we passed the bill, we didn't give Commerce any staffing to oversee the program. We did not provide any kind of subsidies to jumpstart the program. So this recommendation says, yeah, give Commerce enough staff to funding for staff to stand up the program and consider to the extent that there is very little money available right now, but if we can provide some subsidies to the program to jumpstart it, that would be good. Third recommendation is that we should have the Department of Labor and Industries Construction Code Council develop a Minnesota appropriate version of the insurance industry's fortified roofing standard describing how roofs should be rebuilt to qualify for the Strengthened Minnesota Homes Insurance Program. So the fortified standard that the IBHS insurance group has put together is largely informed by the experience of states along the Gulf Coast or the southern Midwest, where the primary risk are hurricanes and tornadoes. Alabama has actually been a leader in this. Oklahoma has instituted a program as well. But we probably don't need to build our roofs to hurricane standards. And so this recommendation is that we have the Construction Codes Council, which is the process through which we put all recommended changes to the building codes, to have them go through their regular process to come up and tell us what they think the appropriate level of standards should be for a Minnesota home, knowing that our main risks are wind damage and hailstorms. We had a proposal to enable catastrophic and mitigation savings accounts. So these are like health savings accounts for your roof. Five is continued legislative examination of issues related to third-party litigation financing. And then six was continued legislative examination of tort reform. So we had one whole session where we talked mostly about legal issues and had a really good discussion, didn't necessarily come to any conclusions except that to note that especially that there do seem to be ambiguities in the on the tort laws related to these issues and that we should continue to look at that. So this is kind of these two items are kind of a passion project for Senator Seeberger, and she has been developing legislation around these issues and will continue to do so. So I'm kind of looking to her. She was a member of our task force to continue refining her legislation on these two subject areas. And then, from the Homeowners Association group itself, seven says, you know, we should consider legislation that would require HOA unit owners to carry what's called HOA 6 coverage that would pay the owner's share of communal assessments. So members of, if you have a condo, you probably would have this, HO6 is a standard admitted markets product, regulated product, but it's basically your umbrella policy for your unit and covers damage to the interior part of your unit and as well as your anything that you might be assessed in, as a share of repairing communal the damage to the communal property as well. So almost all members have this kind of coverage, but a few don't, and the homeowners associations then regularly run into problems in situations where there is an assessment, and the unit owners that lack this coverage have trouble, you know, coming up with the money to pay their part of the assessment. And then we considered, but did not adopt it. This had a motion on a, that failed on a tie vote that would request clarifications as to the time limits, especially related to the mediation process. So there are a couple of these things. If I go back, I'm probably going to carry my legislation myself related to probably the first three. And again, we didn't finish our work until February 5th, so any legislation that will come out of this is still in the revisor's queue, if not in in-house research. So I think if members are interested in carrying legislation in these areas, I'm happy to handhold as well. But we will expect to have, by the time the dust settles, have legislation coming forward from various members on just about all of these recommendations. And so that's it. So questions, discussion.
Representative Elkins, thank you for taking the lead on this for the committee. It was something that we wanted to do last year. We do have some things. This is an ongoing process, but we do have some jumping off points, if you will, in being able to look at this. And members, number seven, requiring HOA homeowners insurance. And so this is kind of the week we're talking about HOAs and a little bit today. This is something we could put in as a disclosure in a buyer's information that they receive, the importance of, and have some statutory language in there about the importance of an HO6 and the assessment provision and why that's important. Or it's just a thought on here. We were talking about people taking those. With that, we have one member question right now. Representative Davids, or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like to thank Co-Chair Elkins Co-Vice Chair Elkins for serving on this committee, first of all, and for making this presentation. This is a real problem.
Yeah.
It's a real problem out there right now. A few months ago, I got a rent increase, and it kind of hurt my feelings because it was quite a bit. And I went to the owner of the building, and I said, what's the deal here? Mm-hmm. And all he did was bring out his insurance bill.
Yep.
Because it had gone up so much. And this is a nice building. This is not a bad building. And they couldn't find insurance for it. And basically it had more than doubled. So these coverages are hard to get right now, and I think the legislature will need to take action. The deductibles, like on my homeowners, I get the bill and it's like $5,000. I get the bill for $8,500.
Yeah.
No claims. But I understand how it works. It's claims all over the place. And my deductible went up to a mandatory $5,000.
Yeah, deductibles are
for my house.
Yeah, deductibles are climbing as well.
So I think, like I said, I want to thank you for this because we do need to look very closely into this because it's a problem for a lot of people.
Yeah, we have nonprofit housing developers, providers who are finding their very viability challenged just by because of the amounts they're having to pay for insurance for their affordable housing units. And we're even in not so much here yet, it's starting to happen, but if you're in Florida, for example, people are buying homes and then they can't close on them because they can't afford the insurance company that to meet the mortgage holder's insurance requirements. So we don't want to get there.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm an insurance agent. Generally, I like price increases because I do very well with price increases, but this is out of hand. So thank you for your work.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank Representative Elkins for a couple of things. First of all, the way you've approached this and approached all of your work, you're always very sincere and you work in an area of knowledge and policy first. And I would just want to say that, it's nice to have someone who I look at this issue and say, okay, I'll just talk to Elkins rather than research it. So that's a refreshing breath of air down here. And just that we'll get to your recommendations and hopefully we can enact some of the provisions that you put together. But thank you. There's not enough of this. And I just want to keep encouraging that.
Thank you.
Representative Elkins, were there others who might be present today that would want to testify that
perhaps
were on the committee? We have
Mr.
a few minutes, but I can't take like all 14 of your members and have each of them speak to the issue. Representative
Representative Elkins, I see that Mr. Cocking is coming. I know he was instrumental in helping us put this together last year as well. Mr. Cocking, welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and share your thoughts.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Cocking, President and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We represent the state's property casualty insurers. And I'll start off just by thanking Representative Elkins for the work that he did in putting this together. And I do think there were a lot of productive conversations. It's too bad that Representative Davis left the room. I think there's a number of things that we could get into on. I think anybody that has insurance and has seen what their premiums are doing was probably excited to see that this committee was stood up so we can evaluate that. And I think that, I think it's contained in the report when you get kind of the appendices. I thought something that stood out on page 25, which was a letter written by a member of the task force. And she talked about one of the challenges is rooted in unrealistic consumer expectations and lack of consumer education. And I feel like that is, if I could sum up what I think a lot of challenges are overall, hits the nail on the head. I think we have everyone that wants, platinum coverage at tinfoil prices, and unfortunately that's not the way insurance works. As Representative Elkins talked about climate change and the impact that that's having, insurers and the price that you pay for insurance is the direct link and the direct correlation as a result of climate change. Your insurance premiums are the tangible number, if you can boil it down to anything, that we are all paying as a result of climate change. And so I appreciate the work that this task force had done on trying to get at what some of these root causes are. I know there were a number of things that we addressed that we put out there that from the insurance industry we're seeing that are driving these costs. I like the notion of some of what's adopted, and I think it's up to the legislature to decide, do we want to try to bring these claims costs down, or, do we want to, maintain the status quo and see where premiums go, and I really think that's the trade-off. And I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any, Mr. Chair.
Sure. We do have a question from Representative.
Real quick on to that. I mean, I think real quick, Mr. Chair. So I think Mr. Cocking is completely right, and this is why I think one of the more tangible recommendations out of this is, I think there was kind of a consensus in the group that we need to start upgrading our. This is going to be around a while. We need to start strengthening our roofs. So just so we're not quite as vulnerable as we are to this damage.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both. In my reading, I'm interested in what you were just saying about how consumer education is going to be a part of this because costs are going to continue to go up due to climate change and other unpredictable factors. But in my reading, I also noted that record profits for these insurance companies were recorded last year, and they continued to rise. Is that accurate? Because it seems to me like there's a rising effect not just on the cost we're paying, but on the profits y'all are making on those rises.
Mr. Cocking.
That's not true in Minnesota. A New York Times article from 2024, Minnesota insurers, the only state in the nation where insurers had lost money in each of the previous 5 years, 8 of the previous 10 years. Insurers paid out on the homeowner side in 2022, $1.92 for every dollar collected in premium. I will tell you, and I know those numbers get aggregated nationwide, and there's other states that don't face the climate issues that we do in Minnesota that don't have the same level of wind and hail exposure that we do in Minnesota, that maybe insurers are able to price a little more aggressively, but I will tell you that is certainly not the case in Minnesota.
Representative Finke, follow-up?
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate you. I appreciate those details because I do think that, consumers may not be understanding that they have to pay more, but consumers are paying more for everything. So I just want us to be hesitant to say it's the fault of their lack of education rather than the sort of shit sandwich that we've all been sort of fed lately. Excuse my language. I apologize.
It's a technical term, I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr.
But
Chair.
It's just a compounding levels of cost. So I just want to make sure we're clear on that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Finke, I would say that I don't mean to say that the lack of consumer education on why they're paying more is the reason. I think the challenge is consumers generally don't understand insurance broadly. So when it comes time for a claim, nobody reads their policy or knows what's in it. And we saw there was a representative here from Beltrami County. Bemidji was obviously hit with the derecho at the end of June. And they came forward and said, oh, you know, nobody knows what was in their policy. You know, these insurers are putting this stuff in. And the reality is, as much as I wish that everybody would sit down and read their policy when their renewal comes diligently and knows what's in it so that, you know, they're prepared come claims time, that's not what happens. And people come claim time and they think that they've bought coverage that covers everything, and that's not the case. And I wish we could do more around consumer education. I know that's something that our industry is interested in. I don't mean to put the blame on consumers. That's not what I was at all what I was trying to say. There's just a lack of consumer awareness as far as what we do in understanding of insurance.
Yeah. Representative Elkins, and we have 8 minutes, and we have 4 members, and we have some other business to take care of. So let's manage our time.
Yeah,
because we are coming back to these issues.
Yeah.
This is just the introduction and getting it out of the chute as we start working on specific pieces of legislation and the like. And I appreciate people's engagement. Representative Elkins, and then we're going to go to Representative Kreisha.
Personal perspective on this is somebody who's, I've lived in my home, the current home, for 41 years. I've had my roof replaced once because of hail damage. And then I kind of expected that as a result of a hailstorm about 2 years ago, I would get another new roof. And my insurer, you know, turned me down. But I think among homeowners like me, there's an expectation that's been developed over the years that, probably about once every 20 years, I'm going to get a new roof because of hail damage. And, for me as a consumer, is it realistic that, my current 25 years, old roof at this point, that if there's a hailstorm, that I'm going to get, it completely, covered by my insurance company? That's probably an unrealistic expectation. And I think that that's the sense in which we as consumers need to be more cognizant of issues like this, especially given climate change.
And Representative Kreisha, followed by Representative Van Binsbergen. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, and I'll be concise, Mr. Chair. So Representative Elkins, into your testifier, Mr. Cocking. A couple quick things. You mentioned the awareness thing, and I just want some light, and then I'm going to look for a quick comment from you. But I hear all the time, I'm sure many of us have heard, I got a chip in my windshield. Oh, go get full coverage, then wait a week and turn it in. I mean, that kind of awareness and that kind of behavior is what we have. Now, I expand that a little further because I think we as legislators, we hear stories, and there's been many, many things I've seen in commerce where, hey, we're just going to come in and enforce this coverage. And so what I want to say to that, Representative Elkins, and to your testifier, everyone, how much of that do you have to pay attention and fight off when things are brought forward in the legislative process that suddenly will have to be done in a covered situation, which should have been handled in a legal situation or a settlement? So has any of that been identified, if that makes sense?
Well, Mr. Cocking, or did you want that to Mr. Cocking or Representative Elkins?
Probably
Representative
both Kreisha? Of us. I'll go first, and then Aaron can go. But I think most of us, I've had the same insurance company, same agent for 41 years. Every year I get a renewal statement. Do I really look at it closely? No. So why we're looking at them more closely, or should be looking at them more closely, because we are going through this transitional period where, because of climate change, many more damage claims, are deductibles in many cases are going up, and we need to be prodded to just pay closer attention to those renewal statements when they come out every year, and maybe go shopping.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kreisha, just briefly on that, I think to your root question, what the legislature does, the legislature's got broad authority to tell insurers whatever they want, but none of that is free. It all comes at a cost. And so as you sit around and you hear from your constituents about the premium pressure on your premiums going up, recognize that the legislature's got broad authority to tell insurers what they have to do, but it all comes with a cost.
And when legislatures, artificially clamp down on the insurance rates, insurers just leave the market.
Correct.
Thank you.
No truer words ever spoken, Representative Elkins.
I'm sorry?
No truer words ever spoken. We've got states across the country that are seeing that.
Yeah.
Representative Van Binsbergen, and then we're going to give the final word to Representative Kegel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your work on this. I've got firsthand knowledge of this. It affects my business. I'm in the property management business. I own managed apartment buildings in the space you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's a huge issue for our business. And I just want to piggyback on a comment that Chair Davids said about affordability. There's two things that affect our budgets. And one is insurance rates. And so naturally it gets passed on down because we have to raise rents. There's another thing that is happening here in this place that is also causing an affordability issue, and it's all the stuff that we pass down lower to us, and it's in taxes. And as we put our budgets together, there's two things that raise rents. It's the insurance costs, and it's the taxes and the mandates that come down out of this place. And so we want to make Minnesota more affordable. We need to think real hard before and the laws and the things that we are pushing. So thank you.
We are going to be bringing this topic back at some point in the future. So I know members are on the list wanting questions, and I'm going to dispense with my follow-up questions as well, just in the interest of time. And I do want to give Representative Kegel the opportunity to respond today, as we do with chairs and co-chairs back and forth. And she may also want to tell us what's coming up tomorrow, as we need to be out of here at 10 o'clock because we've got another committee coming in, so it'd be out of respect for them. And again, we will come back to this topic, I promise you. Representative Kegel, you will have the final word on that. On the subject in front of the committee right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I have a hard time believing that, you know, last year Allstate posted $10 billion in profits. Progressive had almost $3 billion in profits. And so I have a hard time believing when I look at the numbers, and even the aggregated data out of Minnesota shows that there's an 83% rate loss ratio for one of the large insurers here. And so I'm really concerned about costs going up but profits going up at the same time. Doesn't seem to be very fair. And, you know, it kind of piggybacks on, you know, what Rep. David said is, you know, it seems like the rich keep getting richer and the rest of us are starving. And so I just really want to...
Mr. Chair, what did I say?
We can talk about it afterwards. I think it was just maybe a slight mischaracterization of your statement.
So.
But.
Well, again, this is not a Democrat versus Republican thing. This is a top versus bottom thing, and we need to make sure that, you know, when companies are posting record profits, but yet the rest of us are paying more, that we really look into that and figure out what's going on. Because I just, again, you know, the little people are getting screwed, so.
Representative Kegel, do you want to share what is coming up tomorrow?
What is coming up tomorrow? We have the
cryptocurrency tomorrow.
Bill tomorrow. House File 2700, which I believe is Representative Elkins' data privacy bill.
What's the bill number?
Oh, and then the cannabis testing exemption that Representative Hansen has carried. So, thank you for my memory over here. As my CA.
Very good. And Representative Elkins, I don't have time to give you the final word, but we are coming back to this because of the important nature of the topic. Members, with that, we are adjourned.
Yes, sir.